their smoldering opposition to despotism simply been emboldened at long last and summoned into the once fearful space of Tahrir Square by the chance overthrow of a tyrant in Tunisia and the advent of the social network. Put another way, are greater purposes than our own being worked out in the twists and turns of this present time? Or do the events that unfold before us signify nothing more than one damn thing after another? You hypocrites, said Jesus, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? History, wrote Russ Duffat one brief but tumultuous week ago, history makes fools of us all. We make deals with dictators and reap the whirlwind of terrorism. We promote democracy and watch Islamists gain power from Iraq to Palestine. We leap into humanitarian interventions and get bloodied in Somalia. We stay out and watch genocide engulf Rwanda. We intervene in Afghanistan and then depart and watch the Taliban take over. We intervene in Afghanistan and stay and end up trapped there with no end in sight. How are we, hypocrites one and all, to read the signs of the times, to interpret the present moment? Is it ever possible to trace God's graceful hand in human history, to connect the outbreak of freedom with the breaking in of God's grace tangibly? Or must it be the case with us as it was with the biblical writers, that we read God only retrospectively into what has been remembered? Must the task of interpreting the present time be left to our children's children, as from a measured distance they reach back in memory to bear witness to the slight coincidence of our terrible defeat or triumphant victory with God's purposes? Silence on a Sunday morning in the face of the clamorous calls in Egypt for freedom and liberation seems to me this morning downright unbiblical. After all, if Joshua could declare on the verge of Jordan, "Hereby you shall know that the living God is among you," why can we not know the same? I wonder on this morning, what I remember wondering on a Sunday morning after the toppling of the Berlin Wall, and on the Sunday morning when Nelson Mandela walked out of a prison cell on Robben Island, and on the Sunday morning when I woke to news of Saddam Hussein's capture. I wonder if words concerning current turns in history can become a proclamation of the gospel, or whether they can only be the projection of a merely human perspective upon the ultimate mystery of God. Last Sunday, we dealt with the topic of how God intervenes or does not intervene in our personal lives, in our prayers. tradition that will go to great lengths, or at least it used to keep from identifying finite human achievements or orders or causes with the ultimate ends of Almighty God. Idolatry, we call such identification, and there is no document that speaks more directly to this than the Theological Declaration of Barman, written by the Confessing Church during the rise of the Third Reich and included in our Book of Confessions. We reject the false doctrine, it reads, as though the Church were permitted to abandon the form of its message and order to its own pleasure or to changes in prevailing ideological and political convictions. And again, we reject the false doctrine as though the Church, in human arrogance, could place the word and work of the Lord, capital W, in the service of any arbitrarily chosen desires, purposes, and plans. So we live in a tension that most of the time we can ignore. The tension between our witness to a God who is living among us, working out divine purposes in history, and our confession that nothing in human history save Jesus Christ can be identified directly with the reality of the living God. It is in that tension that we must remain today if there is any gospel to be had in the events of the week just past, and if we ever rightly are to interpret the present time. The key to any reading of the news for those who mean to follow Jesus simply has to do with our beginning place. If we begin with the events themselves, and from these events make our way to God's will in history, we will inevitably come up with a God who is shaped by our own, albeit enlightened, perspective. We are people, you and I, most of us anyway, I think, here today, who have cut our teeth on democracy, who have bet our lives on a market economy, who have flourished in a system that relies on a free press. I promise you that all of those instincts which have me looking to the outbreak of freedom in Tunisia and Egypt and Jordan and saying to myself, "Hereby you shall know that the living God is among you," their instincts born as much from my citizenship as from my Christian faith. All the hopes I have pinned on the triumph of young Egyptians camped out, even now, in Tahrir Square, issue from a faith in a God who acts in history to make the world over in the image of my own experience. Such are the conclusions about the nature of God if history itself is our beginning place. That is why Reinhold Niebuhr so rightly observed that the revelation of divine mercy in a suffering Savior was not a conclusion about the nature of God at which people might arrive if they analyzed the causes, sequences, and coherence of the world and deduced the structure of existence from those observable phenomena. Let me say that in plain language. He's saying, sort of what I just said, that in no way, if we looked at the world and started with the world, would we conclude that God would be made known in a suffering servant. Why? Because it is not to the experience of suffering, but to the triumph of freedom we naturally turn, rushing to the Bible for a multitude of references in support of the notion that God is for the kind of democracy which we have come to cherish for ourselves and for all people. But the Bible, for those of us here, is not meant to be a book to which we go in the second place. The starting point for you and for me, if ever we are to confess our faith in connection with the events of the present time, is with the God who has been revealed at the center of history in the person of Jesus Christ. It is in him and through him that the purposes of God in history have been made known. By his life, death, and resurrection, the church is given a word made flesh through which to discern the presence of the living God. Therefore, who we know God to be in him and who we know ourselves to be in him, finally and fully human, is where we must begin to see, to interpret. For one thing we know, he rejected all current readings of history, and so all popular expectations of a Messiah, which again, in Niebuhr's words, involved God's miraculous intervention in history for the purpose of eliminating its moral obscurity. Let me just say that Jesus rejected all popular understandings of history, of who he was in history, what he was to do in history, that involved God's miraculous intervention in history for the purpose of eliminating moral obscurity. For giving us the possibility of saying in any given moment in history, I know exactly God's will, and God's will exactly coincides with my side of the argument. The God we know in Jesus Christ is not a God entering history to overthrow governments, or a God leading armies off to war, the Old Testament perspective notwithstanding, or a God residing in the political movements of the day. In fact, one of the frustrating things about Jesus was that he could not be pinned down politically, only nailed up by way of human politics to suffer death on a cross. There, on the cross, the sovereignty of God was revealed for all time in the paradox and power of a love that suffers. How do we know that the living God is among us? If we begin with Jesus, perhaps it is not to the triumph of the human spirit we turn in the present time, but to the continued torture of human bodies and souls that we must turn if we are to bear witness to the suffering love of our living God. As I'm about to board a plane on Tuesday for a week of conversation with people from all sides of the political spectrum in Israel, I think of Palestinians without hope in the Gaza Strip. I think of women and children who, though free, will be haunted for the rest of their lives by the memory of the rapist who killed them no less than a bullet in Sudan. I think anew of Abu Ghraib, those tortured and those ordered to torture, whose lives are unfolding on a stage in Center City. With Christ as my guide, I say the very opposite of what without him I would conclude. Hereby, and in these places of suffering, you shall know that the living God is among you. But more. For in him I know in a way I would not know without him, how far the greatest least human freedom flourishes only long enough to elect a new despot. Yet what we do know, as we look at the long arc of history, is how old every new human arrangement ends up being when judged against the new thing God has done in Jesus Christ. To repeat, we make deals with dictators and reap the whirlwind of terrorism. We promote democracy and watch Islamists gain power from Iraq to Palestine. We leap into humanitarian interventions and get bloodied in Somalia, and yada, and yada, and yada. What do we mean by all this, asks Karl Barth, of those moments in history that seem to teeter or now tweeter on the boundary of a new epoch? Are we to imply that we are to bury all of our hope, to fold our hands and say, alas, a new time, another time, there will never be? No. But rather say, the really new time, for which we are waiting, of which the Bible speaks in sublime language, is unspeakably greater than and wholly different from anything we may call new and other. So great and so different is the new time for which you and I are waiting that everything that appears among us as new and different is in contrast to the truly new, again, only old. The singularly new thing under the sun. And so the only one to whom the church can and ought to point with any assurance in any present time is Jesus Christ. In him, we behold the love of the living God. In bread and wine, we remember what his body broken and blood poured out for the world God loved in this way. In him, you shall know that the living God is among you. Such was the witness of a flawed and forgiven man named Alan Bozak, who wrote in the midst of the struggle of his own people to be free. Somehow, I don't know why, I turned to the words of John of Patmos, and for the first time I began to understand. The power of his testimony changed my life. Since then, I have preached, marched, demonstrated. Half my ministry has become a confrontation with the South African government and its forces, in the pulpit and because of that, in the streets. Arrested, threatened, imprisoned in solitary confinement,